and welcome to River Writers, a production of the Writers Guild of Astoria, a 501c3 nonprofit supporting writers and the literary arts in Astoria and the Lower Columbia region. I'm your host, Marianne Monson. Aired the second Monday of each month at 9 a.m., River Writers provides a chance to peek behind the curtain at the craft of writing. What motivates writers to do the work they do, and what do they learn through their creative process? I'm excited to have in the studio with me today author Mike Stark, who recently released the book, The Derelict Light, a novel based on the Astoria fire of 1922. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, very happy to have you. I've been excited to sit down with you. We had you recently at the Astoria Library for an author talk, and it's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Thank you.
So, congrats on the new novel. It's a really fantastic, I think I mentioned at the event that I had been thinking for a while that someone should write a novel based on the fire of 1922, and here you showed up and had done it. So I'd love to start with what brought you to the craft of writing at the very beginning. Can we start there?
Sure. I think that stories have always been really important to me. And I think also at a young age, I took to language. I took to thinking about how words work and understanding the power of words, and later sort of the construction of sentences and understanding what a sentence and a paragraph can do. It's kind of seems very basic, but I think understanding sort of those building blocks at an early age. But then I came up as a reader, as a young person, and I didn't really dream of being a writer when I was a young person. I was more of a reader, just devouring books like a lot of kids. I just couldn't get enough, and my bedroom exploded with books like it still does today. But at some point, I came to think about behind all of these stories and books, there was somebody who had done this, had made this kind of out of nothing. And so that's really where I've started thinking about what writing is, and am I a person who could do it?
That's great. So what were some of those early books that inspired you to become a writer?
I loved Roald Dahl, mm-hmm. all of his books. They were so funny and weird. And I felt like pulled the curtain back on all these strange universes right next to us. And I love that he... just went into these places and let you inhabit those places with him. And so I found him to be really transportative as a writer. And so I loved his books. I still do. Then getting a little bit older, getting introduced to Steinbeck was, for me, a really powerful person. I love all of his work. And he's even got some nonfiction work that I have really fallen in love with lately. So then just the classics, and then just as I gotten older, getting into more modern writers, but also going back and trying to rediscover authors that I had never picked up before. I'm sort of overwhelmed that there's so much to read. Mm-hmm. And so the stack of books by my bedside is kind of gargantuan, and but what a pleasure, what a problem to have more books to read. It's my taste now is at this point is pretty wide ranging.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that has that problem. I remember when I was researching my Civil War book, my kids were just so fed up with all the stacks of Civil
it's
War
ridiculous.
Books all over
it's ridiculous.
The house.
Yes, absolutely.
And I put their foot down at
right.
one point. I have no Civil War books in the kitchen,
right.
Mom.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
So then you turned to a career in journalism. Is that right?
I did, yeah. So after college, I was a newspaper reporter for, 15 or 20 years, including some time here in Astoria for 3 or 4 years. After Astoria, I went to Montana and Wyoming, where I covered Yellowstone National Park for a newspaper out there for 6 years. That was great. After that, I was at the Associated Press in Salt Lake City, writing national and international stories about the West and covering environmental issues. That kind of daily journalism for me, it was a great way to connect to a different story every day, to understand the long story arcs of the world happening around us, the ongoing stories. how to talk people and take notes and organize your thoughts, and how to write fast. That was really, especially working at the Associated Press, where things are happening in real time really quickly. You have to produce something readable in a very short amount of time that's factual. And that was, for me, kind of transformative in terms of how I write now, which is I tend to be writing in short bursts and get something down and then walk away from it and, you know, come back if I'm writing a longer piece and keep going.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's a really wonderful snapshot as to why so many journalists end up writing fiction, because they really train themselves to put their butt in the chair and produce, right? Like start typing those keys.
You don't have a choice.
Yeah.
You don't have a choice. Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of the quote from Finding Forrester, which is one of those writing movies that I love, where he says, the first step to writing is to write, not to think.
Absolutely. You know, the work is the work, and it's you can walk around and think your thoughts all day long, but words on the page, you know, that is really where the rubber meets the road. And they're not always good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're often not good or, you know, need a lot of editing. But I do feel like, you know, a productive day is putting something on the page and not worrying too much about, is this perfection? But am I getting something done? And then you can come back and edit and work through it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. So tell us a little bit about the time you spent in Astoria as a reporter.
Yeah, I mean, I loved being here. So I covered the city of Astoria. I covered the Coast Guard. I covered the Columbia River. And so there was, of course, murder and mayhem all the time. But there are also some really important ongoing stories. I went up to Alaska for 10 days to cover the commercial fishing up there. All of the people in Astoria that would go up there every summer to fish the salmon runs in the Bristol Bay. So I went up with a photographer and spent some time on boats and in canneries with them, and came back and told a multi-day series about what that life is like. So, you know, I found that Astoria is a fascinating place with really important stories to tell and really great people here. There's sort of a story on every corner in Astoria, either that's being told in real time, you know, right in front of us now, or has been in the past. And so that was the other thing, is I feel like history is very much alive and part of the context here in the city. It's not like other places where the history can feel very short or very shallow. It's very deep and meaningful here, which I love.
True. Me too. Yeah, it's a magical place in that way. So you were working for the Daily Astorian at the time and covering mostly environmental and also fishing topics. Did you get involved with fisher poets too?
Just as a spectator
and a
lover of that. I found that that was one of the things when I first got here. I couldn't believe that that was a thing. And I went down and like the poetry was amazing. And the people that were writing it were amazing. And that was also one of those things where I just, part of what was falling in love with Astoria is that, and that was just one thing in Astoria.
Yeah.
You know, one small aspect of it, but it was so amazing that it was, had a life of its own. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It is really beautiful. So tell us a little bit about the transition to fiction. I mean, I'm seeing from our conversation so far, some of the building blocks that were there, like it seems in your reporting where you're asking questions in a way, when you're doing that with fiction, you're just doing that, but these are two people in your head, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, this is my third book. So my first two books were nonfiction books. They were both journalistic works of history. One is about a shipwreck in Yellowstone National Park that's called Wrecked in Yellowstone. And that's a story about this guy who had a crazy idea to bring a boat into the middle of Yellowstone National Park to a big lake there, brought it in piece by piece and assembled it on the shore of Yellowstone Lake, and along the way angered the Park Service and sort of the entire business structure there. Ended up getting kicked out of Yellowstone because he was such a nefarious character. So I told that story. That was in 2016. And then in the spring of 2022, I had another nonfiction book come out called Chasing the Ghost Bear. And that's about the search for the biggest bears that ever were here in North America, called the giant short-faced bear. It was here just in North America during the Ice Age. So both of those books were works of nonfiction. And so, you know, that whole process was a process of excavation through the historical record. And a lot of that work is finding where all the disparate scraps of history are, pulling them all together and creating a narrative that is cohesive and telling to tell the truth about that topic for each of those. So for this book, The Derelict Light, you know, I had initially intended to tell the story of the Astoria Fire of 1922 as a nonfiction book. And so I was here on several research trips going through the historical records. And, you know, there was a lot of the story there, but I didn't feel like I found the whole story there. There were threads that were unresolved with certain people and who may have actually started the fire. And so, you know, at a certain point, I was in despair for a while, feeling like I'd put all this time and research and even some writing into this book that was going to be a nonfiction book about the fire. So I set it aside for a while, worked on my bear book, and then ultimately came back to the Astoria Fire book. I just couldn't quite let it go. It was just sort of nagging at me that there was a story there that I really wanted to tell. And so I decided that this could be a work of fiction. And as we were talking about the other night, you know, there's different ways to tell truths, and nonfiction and journalism is one way to tell the truth via facts. But fiction plays a crucial role in telling other kinds of truths about a time, about people, about a human condition. And once I understood that I could tell the story that would be a truth about what happened, it was sort of a relief to kind of let myself go there, not feel like I had to have every single fact pinned down with a historical record, but I could tell a different kind of truth about the fire.
That's great. So it's your third book, and the first two were nonfiction then. And so what would you say, what's the connecting element between the three books?
That's a great question. I mean, I think there's some sort of themes that run through them. I mean, I think one of the themes that I'm always interested in is that the context we live in now has been informed by the context that came before us.
Hmm.
You know, that history isn't something that just lives in the past and we can compartmentalize it and leave it be. I feel like natural history, human history, all of that forms the context that we live in today. And, you know, a place like Astoria with the fire, you know, people think that's, you know, 101 years ago. But that fire really informed what the city looks like today. It informs mm-hmm. Our habits moving through the city physically. It changed the psychology and the development and the culture of the city. And so, you know, I love sort of trying to understand how what happened back then is still, its tendrils are still reaching us in some ways, often in known and even unknown ways.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes so much sense. And I can see that as a through line through the three books, although I have not read the first two. I'm going to have to do that. If you are just joining us, this is Marianne Monson for KMUN's River Writers, sponsored by the Writers Guild of Astoria. And this morning, I'm speaking with author Mike Stark, whose novel, The Derelict Light, recently came out, and it's a novel based on the Astoria Fire of 1922. So let's go a little bit more into The Derelict Light. You've talked a little about researching it. Can you tell us what on the ground research did you do here in Astoria? Did you go down beneath the city? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I have been down beneath the city, and I did that when I was living here first, when I was working for the newspaper, and I had a couple people take me on some kind of amazing tours down there. So when it came to researching this book, I spent a lot of time in the Clatsop County Archives, which are an amazing treasure trove. The people who keep those records and have kept those records are doing that's heroic work in my mind for somebody who relies on history. People that even just to preserve those, to make those records safe, is such an incredible public service. So I spent time with those. I ended up getting a lot of letters and first-person documents. I spent time in Salem looking through the fire marshal's archives. I looked at county coroner records. The Ku Klux Klan plays a kind of a central role in this book, and so I read the records of the Klan in La Grande, which was contemporaneous to the Klan here in Astoria. Mm. So the meeting notes, and so just, you know, the whole thing was trying to get insight into who these people were, what was happening with the culture here, trying to get as close as I can to what reality was really like.
Yeah. So did the Klan in Astoria not keep minutes that you could find?
Not that I could find.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I looked pretty hard.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a certainly like terrible and fascinating piece of a story history that I was kind of excited to see you bring in, because a lot of people don't realize the prevalence of the Klan that was in Astoria, I think, around that it at its height around the time of the fire.
Yeah, I mean, the year of the fire, which was 1922, was this very fraught moment in the city's history. It was the population was peaking. By then the canneries were really running. There was a huge fishing community. There was a big logging community outside of town. You had this whole Scandinavian community that was really well established here. And within that community, there were divisions between the more conservative Finns, say, and the more radical Finns. They had their own newspaper, the Toveri, that was very influential in kind of the radical leftist politics of the time. The Wobblies had come to town trying to organize workers. They were often, handing out pamphlets on the streets, but also getting arrested or getting beaten up. And so, and then you had the Chinese community working in the canneries, had their own enclave in the city. And then, so on top of that, you have the Klan coming in the early 1920s to come in and recruit, kind of as part of the second wave of the Klan in the early 1900s. And they became, a fairly significant force here in Astoria. They had about 900 members. Just a couple months before the fire broke out, they had swept into the city council chambers, getting elected that year. They had one of their people elected as mayor. And so they were really on the cusp and kind of riding this wave, trying to become a legitimate force in society here. And at the time of the fire, it was really starting to work for them.
And I believe that some of the members of the Flavelle family were involved with the KKK too, which fought against women's suffrage, if I'm not mistaken. And that's where it kind of connects with some of my work that I've looked at before. So yeah, anyway, that there was a whole group of women in Astoria who were very anti-women's suffrage for lots of different reasons. They felt like it would end, you know, families,
right,
and communities. And so that was all aligned with,
right,
the outward messaging of the KKK, anyway.
Troubling.
Yeah.
And then there was also prohibition here. And I think a lot of them were also a force into the anti-alcohol, teetotaler movement as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that was a lot of the people who were lobbying against women's suffrage,
right,
too.
Right,
they,
right,
felt like if they gave women the vote, they would never get to drink alcohol again.
Right, right.
So, which is definitely what happened.
Look at us now, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, look at us now. I have a little tidbit for you, though, about the Tavari. That's how you say it, right?
I believe
Tavari.
So. Yeah.
The Finnish newspaper. And you're saying it was a pretty, like, aligned with the Wobblies and IWW.
Correct.
It was a labor paper.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So my house was in Uppertown, was built by Finnish immigrants. And when I was remodeling it 6 years ago when I moved here, underneath the old Congolian floor, between the Congolian floor and the fir floor, is layers of Tavari newspaper in Finnish.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
They use it as insulation.
That's fascinating. I mean, it was a really interesting operation, and it was It's all in Finnish, probably the ones
you've
seen.
It's in Finnish, yeah.
But they were very influential on the West Coast and even certain places around the world. And, you know, there was this, their editors were constantly being replaced because they'd be arrested. Their building would be vandalized. There would be these boycotts of the paper, or they would print the paper and suddenly they would all be disappearing from the streets.
Yeah.
So they were a very controversial and influential operation. Who had ultimately some pretty wide reach for a long time.
Yeah, amazing.
That's cool, though, that it's still like it's underneath still the floorboards and you can still find it. That's awesome.
Yeah, to your point about the present being informed by the past, you know, I think it really aligns with that. So tell me about, so you were doing all this research, which I'm sure felt very familiar to you, you know, with your background in journalism and nonfiction. And then, you know, I'd say one of the major differences, anyway, they're similar in some sense too, but you needed characters. You needed a narrative arc and you needed a narrative thread to pull on. So how did you go about creating that for your novel?
And part of this was giving myself permission to write fiction, which was hard for me as a journalist. You know, you're talking about the facts and real things. And so just in my head, I had to keep letting myself make stuff up, which is weird to say, but that was kind of important for this process. So one of the things I did is, you know, I have characters in the book that are based on real people. Sometimes I use their real names and sometimes I don't. But part of the reason why I did that is because I had the records of what they said and how they talked. And sometimes it was in letters, sometimes it was in a newspaper or other records. And I really like preserving that part of history, even though this is totally a work of fiction, being able to allow their real voices to sort of inhabit this fictional space. But then otherwise, I needed characters to drive the story forward. And so I had to bring in people who are not in the historical record to be part of what happened here. And so sometimes it was, you know, just thinking about the plot and what was important to, you know, where it was important to have a character do such and such a thing. But some of it was I really wanted to represent who was here at the time in a story and really think about what their life was like. And so there are side characters of people, you know, there's police, there's a policeman, there's a woman who was part of the Chinese community. So I really wanted to make sure that they existed in the book and to not only just have them be a passing character, but try to let them inhabit this space as well. So this book ultimately is a kind of a mishmash of real people saying real things and fictional people saying fictional things and sometimes them interacting.
And do you have an author's note where you sort of break down some of that?
I don't.
No. Okay. But that, I guess this serves as your author's note.
Here we are. Here we are. Yes.
Yeah. I do the same thing in my historical fiction too, because sometimes you can prove. So do you take a good, solid, educated guess? Like, do you find evidence that someone could have done what you're having your characters do?
I do. I mean, and to be clear, this book is a work of fiction and sort of my vision of how this fire went down. And a lot of the people who ultimately are accused in this book of some of the acts around this fire is stuff I've made up.
Yeah.
So that is fictional.
Yeah.
But in my imagining, it's real. And I based their actions on what I knew about them from the historical records. And then you have to extend beyond that to say, okay, well, here's what I think could have happened based on what I knew about this person or this organization.
Yeah. So, for instance, one thing you mentioned at the event was that there was a real fire inspector, right? Or investigator.
Correct.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about how you drew on the record, but then changed that a bit?
Yeah. So there was a fire inspector who was in charge of trying to understand what happened. And he ultimately wrote the fire marshal's report about what his suspicions were about how the fire started and his initial thoughts that it was incendiary, was arson that started it. But I decided to make that a female character instead. For one thing, I just think it was more interesting to bring in a different voice, a different perspective to walk through the book, and to also deal with some gender issues at the time in the 1920s and be able to kind of explore that a little bit as well. And so I'm sure the original real fire inspector was interesting, but I think I felt like I found somebody who's more interesting to be a vehicle to carry through the story.
Yeah.
I loved writing about her, and she was just, to me, became one of the most interesting people in the story.
Yeah, she is a really interesting character. And so I would say also the book opens with a hanging, and that is also a real event. But can you talk about the inspiration behind that?
Sure. I mean, in the real fire, there were three people who died, and one person had a heart attack while he was moving some cars out of the way of the fire. Another person drowned while they're jumping from a boat to shore as part of the firefighting. But the third was the most mysterious to me, which was a guy who was found hanging at the end of the Sanborn Docks at the end of 8th Avenue here in town. And really very little was written about him in the aftermath of the fire. And I was always fascinated who is a person who is going to hang himself while the whole town is burning and just absolutely going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very interested in who this person was. And so a lot of my research was trying to figure out who was this person. He had a very vague name, John G. Smith,
mm-hmm.
Which at the time there were a lot of Finnish people, especially working up in the lumber camps, who were changing their names to more Americanized names. And John Smith was a very common one at the time. Still is, I guess. So I ended up really diving into this character in my book and coming up with a whole backstory of him and his family and what his involvement was in the fire. Again, who knows? He is lost to history, sadly. But to my mind, he was a central character into this fire, how it came about, and ultimately being one of the people who paid pretty deep price for what happened.
And did you see the coroner's report? Is that part factual?
I did. I did see it. It was very cursory. The coroner at the time. His was one of the buildings that burned.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, in my mind, he was making a very hasty assessment about what he thought happened. And, you know, they found a guy hanging by a rope and just quickly dismissed it as a suicide.
Yeah.
And moved along very quickly. And, you know, they had other business to attend to, I guess. But I really felt like he got short shrift in terms of trying to understand exactly what happened. There's different newspaper accounts give him even different names and different nationalities. And I think he was kind of just an inconvenience at the time of the investigation. And they sort of wrote him off as somebody who took his own life and moved on very quickly.
That's amazing. You discovered a real mystery and then you filled in the details of one possibility
for us in the
novel.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. Okay, quickly tell us where people can find The Derelict Light.
It's published by the University of Nebraska Press, so that's one place to go. Beach Books in Seaside, which is a great supporter and was at our event the other night. You can also get it through Beach Books in Seaside. I have a website, MikeStarkWrites.com, also.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, Mike. It's been such a pleasure to sit down with you today and talk about this amazing history.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Writers Guild of Astoria is a 501c3 nonprofit promoting literary arts and serving writers in the Lower Columbia region. You can learn more and become a member by visiting thewritersguild.org. Until next time, keep the words flowing and your pencils sharp. I'm Marianne Monson for River Writers.